I'd say maybe one of the first guests to see off a couple of beers throughout the duration of the podcast. and remain totally unchanging as a result. Great.
Yeah, love that. The guy came prepared. He's like, this is a guy who knows he needs fortification to get through this.
We're here sipping our tea like nerds.
What a classic indication of how climbing's changed.
What a bunch of losers.
Right, we've got to introduce him.
Yeah.
There's so much to cover.
National treasure.
Yeah, I mean, it's national treasure territory, isn't it? Okay. Yeah. Should I go for the wing?
Probably UK's most historic figure.
I mean, in climbing or just...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I mean, I don't mean in general.
You know, I might just leave all this in. This might just be the intro.
Oh, nice.
It perfectly explains it. But let's do it. Let's do it. Welcome to the Careless Talk Climbing Podcast with me, Sam Pryor, and my co-host, Aidan Roberts.
Hello.
You join us as we're trying to figure out how to introduce Ben Moon, who is our guest this week. And he's not an easy one to introduce. We've got the cliche klaxon of, this guy needs no introduction. We've got the national treasure klaxon going off. we've got the, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast and not know who Ben Moon is, would you? Cliche.
All of them.
all of them. But anyway, Ben Moon is an iconic British climber. He was around through the 80s, the 90s, all the way up to the modern day. He is now also known for being the eponymous hero of Moon Climbing, the brand. That moon is actually named after Ben Moon, not the lunar object that some people might think.
Which is also on the logo.
Which is also on the logo. Just adds the confusion. But no, he's done a huge amount. He's the hero of so many British climbers even today. And I'm sure there was posters on the wall of Ben of many, many climbers' bedrooms growing up. Not mine, because I didn't get into climbing till I was 18, and by which point Ben was not the current best in the world. That was more Sharma for my era, which is why it's funny that even though when I was getting into climbing, Ben wasn't one of the first people I was looking towards. So he kind of wasn't my hero when I was first starting climbing, but yet he's kind of one of my heroes now because I've kind of got to know him a bit better. And I love his attitude, and he's climbed so much to such a high level. He's climbed top
world's
of the
first 9A.
World's first 9A, but world's first of many grades. He pushed it a hell of a long way. Yeah, he entered climbing before training was really a thing, when it was mostly trad. There wasn't even a great deal of sport climbing. There wasn't even such a thing as board climbing. And Ben has really been in the generation and one of the main pioneers of completely changing the sport to be maybe less of a kind of lifestyle activity, sleeping in a cave on the dole, which he did do, and has ended up as a proper Olympic sport. And I think Ben is one of the main figures that helped the sport get to that position. But yeah, he's climbed loads of hard stuff, which we mentioned, Hubble, very classic, Voyager Sit, obviously famous, Statement of Youth, Agincourt, Maginot Line, they all come up. But at this point, it's just to sort of list some of Ben's accomplishments seems sort of reductive to the guy he is. So he's not very easy to introduce, but thankfully, I'm sure you'll really know him anyway. So I apologize for that awful introduction, but you know who I'm talking about. It's Ben Moon.
Hey, well, thanks for joining us, Ben. Also, if you're listening to the podcast and interested in supporting us, we have a Patreon that offers two tiers, one which gives you access to some extra exclusive content, and another tier which also gives you access to a Discord channel where you can join our fellow community of patroons who also pitch questions. You'll regularly hear us answering questions, so you'll get a little sneak preview of upcoming guests, and you can propose questions, which we'll try and ask throughout the conversation. So if you're interested in supporting us, give it a look. Thanks for listening.
And I'm also due to chat to Ravioli tomorrow morning about the new moon set, which will only be going on the Patreon account.
Wow, tomorrow morning. I'm not involved in that.
No, I thought if we don't have Aiden there, we can nerd out about the intricacies of individual holds on the moon board to our heart's content without boring poor Aiden.
I'm two sessions deep on the moon board, but on the new moon set, but I'm still a moon board newbie, I'd say.
A lightweight.
Yeah. So enjoy your nerd out and thanks for listening.
How you doing, Ben?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Are you recovering?
There's always got to be a sort of tech issue, hasn't there, with these things?
Yeah, normally you'd think we would have figured it out by now, but we really haven't.
I know.
It's so random. Every time, I think half the time I join and then we can't hear each other and I just leave and come back and then it's fine. Yeah, we'll never understand it.
Have you recovered, Ben? Didn't you have hand surgery or something?
Tuesday.
Wow. Look at that.
Yeah, I had surgery on Tuesday for the Dupuytren's. So yeah, it's less than a week since then. I was at the physio today. I got referred to the physio. He's put it in a splint. I mean, it had this massive bandage on after the surgery, and I had the notes that from the hospital said take the bandage off after 48 hours. So I took the bandage off at 48 hours, redressed it because it said redressed it. And so I've had it out of a bandage, not in a splint, for like 4 or 5 days. And I've been, keeping it elevated, but stretching my fingers and stuff because I thought, well, that's what I've got to do. And then I went to the physio today and she was like, oh, you shouldn't have taken the bandage off and we need to put it in a splint.
Oh, wow. That's...
It seems, I don't know. I mean, I'm having the stitches out on Friday, so I'm going to go to the GP on Friday, have the stitches out, see what they say.
No, so getting some serious mixed messages from different folks. Yeah.
I don't know why they would immobilize it. I mean...
Or unless they don't want it to heal slightly closed again like it was, because originally... I mean, they've done that, so giving you your full range of motion back. So yes. I'm guessing they probably want it all to heal up
open,
fully open, and then you'll have the range back.
Yes, I can see that. But I mean, if you're stretching your fingers, if you're doing that with it anyway.
Yeah.
I just think sort of mobility is like really important, isn't it, for everything?
So this was this a surgery for limited mobility?
Yes, I've had it for it first came on about probably 15 years ago. So I've had it for a long time and it's just been getting worse and worse. And it was quite, my little finger was quite, I couldn't straighten it at all. It was okay sort of crimping, but if you want to like jam, you can't jam. You can't put, I don't do a huge amount of jam in, but I do some.
maybe there's a benefit to a finger that can't straighten. You just walk around in a constant half crimp.
Sam Blackwell's got that.
Has he? Really?
One of Sam's hands, like, it's like really bent. He can't straighten it at all. He's got sky hooks
from what? Hands.
Yeah, no wonder he's so damn good.
Yes. Not holding him back.
So is that generally seen as like a climbing related injury, or is that something quite a climbing related issue?
It's supposed to come from some Norwegian gene.
They call it
Dupuytren's disease, I think, but it's really common in climbers, and it's normally generally it's in men. But I know a lot of women climbers, well, not a lot, but I do know quite a few women climbers, so it's definitely aggravated by climbing.
But it just tends to get worse over time. It doesn't get better. So eventually.
It doesn't get better. No. The operation was weird. I haven't been under, I did it under general, under local, not general. Just completely numb your arm. I mean, it's just like, most bizarre thing.
Yeah. Because the only examples I've known of that is when both Molly and Matt Cousins had like a similar surgery. They each had a similar surgery on like a multiple pulley rupture in a finger, and I remember them describing that, and they were like, they were allowed to like look at them do the surgery like on your own arm, which feels very counterintuitive.
They didn't ask me if I wanted to have a look until the end, I mean, I wouldn't have looked anyway because I'm a bit squeamish anyway, I think. So I thought it was going to be really painful in the evening, you know, later on or the next day. But it was fine, actually. Molly had a really bad pulley. I remember seeing a photo of her surgery, I think, actually. Didn't she have a photo of it?
Yes, she put it on Instagram, didn't she?
That was gruesome.
Open surgery.
Oh, some knew people that like it.
I mean, it is fascinating, yeah.
They didn't get minded, did they? The surgeon who did my hand, he's just joined my running club, top the AC, which is quite funny. Cool. The waiting room with the anaesthetic on the day of the thing, and the anaesthetist, and then he said, "Oh, Joe's been telling me you're famous." And then he said, yes, he's a bit nervous about putting on your hands.
Yeah. There's a few professions where the hands really do matter a lot, like pianists and climbers alike, I'd say.
But, I mean, if it goes badly, you better hope he can run faster than you in the running club.
Very good. So hopefully I'll be... Yeah, well, I think I'll be running next week. But, and the other thing the physio told me was, I said, oh, when do you think I'll be able to go climbing again? She said 3 to 6 months. And I was like, what? Bob was climbing after, like, I think 4 or 5 weeks. And he was like, and that was, like, climbing pretty hard.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So three to 6 months, yeah. There's only so far that a climber's going to take a medical professional's advice.
I guess you need to. I'd be interested to know actually what they've done in the surgery, because if with Dupuytren's contracture, I'm not quite sure what it is that actually is the restriction.
No, I'm not exactly sure either. I heard some snipping during the operation, though. quite clearly, like something
off-putting.
Yeah, something's been changed. Yeah, it's not just.
He showed me at the end. Actually, he goes, "Do you want to have a look?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." And he was like, "My whole arm's completely numb." He just cut it open, sewed it back together again, and he goes, "Yeah, it's got really good mobility now. It, like, hyperextends," and he pushed it, like, you know, right back, hyperextended it.
Yeah, but yeah.
I couldn't feel anything.
And you're like, "Oh, careful with my fingers."
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's important to me.
Yeah, when you hear that the guy you're surgerizing is well known for something, and you're operating on his hand, you'd probably rather it wasn't climbing, to be honest.
Yeah. He probably was a bit nervous. He was concentrating hard.
Oh, that's
tap,
high
tap dancing. That would be better. Oh, I mean, that Irish dancing thing where they don't move their hands at all.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Dance.
Hopefully, I'm going to be climbing again within a few weeks.
Was it stopping you climbing, or was it general, like?
It wasn't stopping me climbing.
Functionality.
More functionality. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And having seen Bob have the operation and get over it really quickly, I thought, oh, well, that doesn't look too bad.
Sign me up.
One of those things good to get out of the way before it
exactly.
gets worse and worse. And when you could seize the opportunity, not put on a multi-year waiting list, that's always helpful.
Yes, yeah. They were really efficient, actually. I was impressed.
Surprisingly quick.
NHS, yeah. Really quick. It got cancelled once, but, yeah, no, they're very good. Have you had surgery? We're getting personal now.
Yeah. I've had
what a podcast.
Yeah. I've had a couple, but they've both been localized to my right foot. I had an open fracture when I was just getting into climbing. I think I was probably about 13, 14 or something. I had an open fracture on my foot, which I then got infection in the bone, osteomyelitis, like an infection in the bone. So I had surgery for that. And then a few years later, I took a pretty bad fall in font and shattered my calcaneus. So have had like some...
Same foot.
Yeah. Oh, so at least it's been like localized to one foot. My left foot is completely fine. No problems at all.
How did you do it the third time?
The first time?
First time.
Well, I never used to wear shoes when I was a kid. And I learned the hard way that shoes are pretty practical. So I was just running around barefoot. And I think...
To what age?
I was 14, I think. Yeah. I was getting...
You were still barefoot.
yeah. it was quite comical how long I wore shoes when I went to school and things, because definitely when I but like as soon as I had the opportunity, I'd take my shoes off. And
there was this boy who went to my daughter's school, actually. He turned up there. He wasn't in school, but his brother was in the school. So he used to come to the school. He used to go bare feet all the time, even in winter, and, you know, running in a pop around the playground. It was a bit weird, I have to say.
Yeah. Oh, look at it. It is a bit weird, yeah, looking back at it. But I guess, I grew up in the Lake District, so it wasn't too much broken glass and stuff around, so most of the time it's okay. But yeah, I learned the hard way. I since wear shoes quite often.
Quite often.
We had to do a normal amount.
What did you break it on in Fontainebleau?
Watchtower at Cuvier Rempart. It's like a vertical, or like a slightly over, it's like a prow pillar feature just next to Big Boss.
Oh, right, okay, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so first climb of the trip.
Of course. Day one, lovely.
Day one.
Sandpit there, isn't it?
A sandpit. Yeah, there's one rock. There's one rock.
No.
Yeah, it's like I went back a few years later and there is just one rock and like a full sandpit. Yeah, that was one I hit.
It's a really good landing there, isn't it?
Yeah. Maybe
they are quite high, I agree. I mean, they are quite scary there. I remember falling off. What's the one to the right of Big Boss?
Yeah, Fourmier Rouge.
And falling off the top of that and landing in the sand on my back. And it's totally fine. It was all soft.
Yeah. It is like those kind of like taller boulders in Font are pretty funny for falls, because they're like concave. You end up in like vulnerable position where you kind of like can't really see your feet. And sometimes the landings in Font are often almost too nice, in that like it's so easy to get complacent because you're like, oh, it's just like sand, and sort my pads out a bit less and get a bit slack with it.
I mean, it is generally very good landings, isn't it, I'd say.
Yeah, generally.
I was there in August. I was there in August for a few days. I've not been there for quite a few years. You just forget how good it is, don't you?
Yeah. Every time I go back, same thought.
So much to do.
Yeah. There's like a real excitement whenever dip back into Font. Yeah, you're going quite soon, aren't you, Sam?
Yeah, February.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's not.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, could be raining, but fingers crossed.
I wonder if it's been good, because it's been quite nice here the last week, hasn't it? In the Peak District, it's been fairly nice anyway, like cold and dry.
Wow, we've had the most severe weather up here. We had like snowstorms, which then all froze, and so it was just ice. Now we've had a storm.
Right, should we do a podcast?
yeah.
Sometimes we never get around to that bit, and it just goes on like that for 2 hours, and we just say, right, cheers, see ya. And then I've got to try and make something of it.
Yeah. Well, intervene, Sam.
So one thing that Aidan and I quite often avoid is the kind of like, how did you get into climbing stuff? Because it's quite boring and it's a bit cliche. But actually, what with it being you, Ben, we do need to go back in time a fair way. Maybe not necessarily to exactly
because I'm an old man
when you started. But the thing that I think is so fascinating about you is because you've seen climbing change completely exponentially since you started. Like, it's a completely different sport now. So I'd love to just talk a little bit about what it was like. And I'm thinking more, you know, when you were sort of a teenager and properly getting into it. Because you were living in London, weren't you?
When I was a teenager, I was living in London. I went to boarding school from 11 to 16, though.
Where was that?
In Sussex, in the south of England, south of London, basically. So I was away, from 11 to 16. I was basically at boarding school, which,
Did you climb much then?
Yeah, that's probably when I really got into it properly. I mean, I first started when I was sort of seven, just did it a couple of times on some walking holidays. But yeah, probably got into it at school. We were really lucky that one of my best friends was, it had done a little bit of climbing, so he was really keen. And there was a teacher there, Mr. Gunning, geography teacher, who had done some alpine trips and some climbing and stuff. And so we got like a sort of little club going together with a few people. And that was, yeah, so that was amazing. That's probably when I really sort of properly got into it. But it wasn't very good for my education, because as soon as I got into it, that's all I wanted to do. Yeah, my time went like that, and my exam results went the other way.
Yeah, I think it's a classic.
I failed my, O-levels. Unlike you, Aidan.
Oh, I don't know about that. It is quite a classic story, I feel, that, isn't it? You find climbing and all the rest falls by the wayside. But as you really got into climbing, because that part of the country doesn't traditionally have much climbing, right? Was there, did you have something?
Well, yeah, there's a sandstone outcrop called Bowles Rocks. Well, there's a few sandstone outcrops, Bowles, Harrison's, they're the sort of main ones, and they were about an hour away. And in the summer term, on Saturdays, we used to, with Mr. Gunning, we used to get in the school bus and go there and go top roping, which was amazing. I mean, that was incredible. I mean, it is a little bit like Fontainebleau. It's maybe the rock's not as good quality, but it's a bit like Fontainebleau. It's a bit taller, and it's all generally top roping. I mean, it is softer, the rock, but it's really good. And there was, some quite hard stuff down there. Well, English sort of tech, 6A, 6B, that kind of grade, which was pretty hard back then.
Yeah. Because that was one thing I thought was interesting to talk about. Sam was mentioning that the climbing world has changed quite a lot since then. But in those days, there was much more of like a emphasis on trad, right?
It was all trad, in fact, then. There wasn't any what you'd call sport climbing now. This, I'm talking 82, 83.
So it was a few years later when you were getting, like, for your teenage years, when sport climbing was kind of a growing thing as well, right? You were still a teenager when you did Statement of Youth, right?
Yeah, actually, I was talking to a friend just recently about that. I did Statement of Youth when I was 18. Yeah, 18. In 1984. And I think in 1983. The year before, I did like Axel Attack. I don't know if you know that. That's at Pentru, and that's like a 7A plus. That's a bit like a sport route. It was like an age route that had been free climbed. I suppose that was when things started, turning to sport climbing. So,
have you ever been back on Statement of Youth?
A couple of times, yeah.
Because it would be...
We did a film, an anniversary film, 30-year anniversary, and I went back. I was pretty out of shape, actually, and I tried to do it in a day and fell off right at the top.
Well, perhaps that's due a sequel, because this year it would be the 40th anniversary, wouldn't it?
84, yeah, it would, yeah, oh, that's good, yeah, okay, I need to do that. I need to go back and try and do it. I think they reckon it's quite tough for 8A, which is good.
Most things from that era are now considered tough, aren't they, for the grade?
Yeah, true. Yeah. Lots of things get upgraded, don't they?
So how did you end up putting up a sport climb then at that time? When did the sport climbing revolution kick off? What kind of made you start thinking, oh, I'm going to start bolting things?
I suppose it depends how you define sport climbing. I mean, Statement, is it just a route that's got all bolts? Or is it the way that you climb it? I mean... me and Jerry went to France in the spring of 84, and we went to Buttes and Sassois and Verdon. They were the big sort of three crags at those times. And we met some of the top French climbers then, like the Ménestrel brothers and Jean-Baptiste Tribute and stuff. And we saw how they were climbing over there, where they were sort of, well, it was all bolted routes anyway, but they were also working routes and then red pointing it. They weren't doing yo-yos. Like we were, which was climbing from the ground, not practicing it. And every time you fell off, you lured back down to the ground. Although, we started dogging and stuff like that.
And to be clear, dogging. When you say that, you mean...
not that kind of dogging.
Continue to attempt the route until you reach the top.
Yeah, I don't know where that phrase comes from in climbing. It's called hang dogging, isn't it? Hang dogging.
Yeah.
Oh, is that
you're
right?
Hanging on the rope and then you're dogging.
Yeah, it's very like common chat amongst climbers, but I've never actually seen an example of it so out of context. But yeah.
So we saw how the French were doing things, and then we went, when we went back to England in the, after that trip to France, that was with Jerry. I think Jerry did Revelations in 84, and I'm never sure. And I did Statement and stuff. But we still, I think, we still yo-yoed the routes. We didn't, even though they were, I think we red-pointed. I don't know when I first red-pointed a route in the UK, to be honest. It would have been 80, 85 maybe or something. I don't know.
I guess it's not for sake of people not really ever thinking to red-point things. It's probably quite obvious that dogging a route is going to be more beneficial for doing a route quicker. So there's kind of like just like a general...
I'm not dogging a route.
Yeah. Then yo-yoing it and going from the ground whenever you fall off. So is
dogging was, when people started dogging routes, I mean, that was quite controversial, wasn't it?
Like county ethics that you'd have up in Northumberland where like they just ground up everything, even when it's high. It's kind of, it gets shunned if you don't do it. It's kind of just like an ethos of like a community, I guess. To then change it to red pointing, it takes someone quite bold to be like kind of happy to push the boat out and do something new. And I guess potentially bear the scrutiny of that.
Yeah, I think the routes just got too hard. The routes got too hard too quickly. That's why that style was adopted. And it's the same for trad climbing now in a way, isn't it? Like everything's head pointed. All the hard stuff's head pointed, isn't it?
Yeah.
Obviously doing stuff ground up is like the best form of climbing, isn't it? I mean, you know, with no practice, you know, working out as you go and everything. I mean, if you only did stuff ground up, you'd well, there'd be a lot more new routes to do, wouldn't there?
Yeah, it would take so much longer as well, yeah. What did climbing media look like in sort of 1984, Statement of Youth time? Was there magazines? There must have been.
What magazine was there? There was Mountain Magazine. Yeah, there was. There's Mountain Magazine and Climb and Rambler. They were the big magazines at that time. So, yeah, that's where they would report news.
So how would you tell them that there was news? Because at the time you were once a month.
It's crazy, isn't it? You think how much stuff there's on like on the internet these days.
Yeah, if you're going to make a modern day analogy, your Instagram refreshes once per month.
Once a month.
And were you still dossing in a cave at this point?
I was dossing in a cave when I did Statement. Yes, we were over. I was living in Sheffield, but we were over at Pentruan for like 6 weeks or something, just camping in the cave. I was on the dole then, so I wasn't working. I had getting money from the government, not very much, but enough.
Enough. If you're willing to sleep in a cave, I guess you don't need so much. Rent is cheap.
Yeah. It's quite a bold thing. Oh, it's quite like
weird
to step away. Oh yeah. Well, I guess like I can see why you'd be hesitant to step away from like what would be a conventional structure of going to work and having a job and being like, okay, climbing is no longer just something I love to do. I am just going to do some climbing, and this is like kind of for this period of time, this is going to, I guess, be my priority. Even if your standard of living takes a hit. Like, was it quite counterintuitive or?
Like... I wasn't planning anything. Yeah. You completely, I'm sure you were both the same. You're just in the moment, aren't you? You just, that's all you want to do is like climb. You don't care about anything else.
And you didn't have, no one was saying to you, Ben, you gotta get a job.
You can't live in this cave forever.
Who would say that? My mum. Well, I suppose my mum, but I don't know. She was down in London. I think as long as I was happy, that was all she was worried about, really. I think she'd maybe partly given up on me because basically after I failed my exams at boarding school, the O levels, the school didn't want me back. So then I ended up going into a sixth form college in Kingston, my local town, to do retakes. And I mean, that was just, oh, it was horrendous. I couldn't stand it. I had 3 hours of physics on a Thursday. And I just used to bunk off and go get on the train and go to the sandstone outcrop that I was telling you about and go traversing on my own and stuff.
So I presume the physics exam didn't get ace.
No, I packed in college after a term and a half, I think.
and then, you're going to end up living in a cave.
My mum was like, well, if you're not going to school, you're not staying here unless you get a job. So I got a job stacking shelves in a factory nearby. And I did that for 3 weeks and then left that. And she was like, well, you're not staying here if you're not going to work. And so I left home.
Do you remember what caused you to leave that job? Did you by chance bunk off to go climbing?
I mean, I was there 3 weeks, but I'll tell you what, there was a fast turnaround of staff.
You saw a few generations of employees in that time. On the back of Sam's mention of media at that time, and I kind of have quite a nice image of that time being like kind of magazines and also like whispers through the climbing communities. I feel like you see little testaments of that cropping up. There's like Mauk's One Armour at the Tour, or like kind of like even just, I remember, I think Jerry was in at the schoolroom a number of years ago when Alex was climbing there, and he was like looking at the board and he was like, oh yeah, I think Malk did like this move or something. There's all like these kind of whispers, which I kind of think is quite fun. But obviously whispers don't make you a professional. And so how was a turnaround from going living in a cave on benefits? Because it wasn't so many years later when you were a professional climber, right?
No, I think the first money I got was from Wild Country. I think it was in 85, so the year after statement. And they gave me 200 quid to go to sort of fund a trip to Buttes. So yeah, that was the first money we got. It was the same. I mean, it's the same as it is now, I suppose. You just needed to get in the magazines if you were doing sort of hard climbs in the in a magazine, and they were getting published in the magazines. You know, you could try and get some sponsored contracts.
Did the magazines pay you at all to feature your routes and pictures and things?
Yeah, they used to pay for. Yeah, you used to pay per word that you wrote. Photographers got paid, so yeah, they did pay. Yeah, not much, but I mean, they did pay something.
Was that Buttes trip the one when you did Agincourt? Was that then? No, was that later?
That was later. I think it was when I did Shuka or The Rose and the Vampire or something like that, which were two of the hardest routes in Buttes at the time.
Okay, so we're spinning plates here, because as we go chronologically, there's loads of different sort of veins of things I want to kind of cover. I think we're going to revisit the finance side of it a few times as we move through the years. But were there any comps as early as 1985?
I was about to say, comps, the first comp I did was in 86. That was Arco. There were two comps, Arco and Bardenekea, but there had been one the year before in 85. I think that was the first competition, as far as I'm aware.
And I think I remember reading somewhere that actually there was relatively decent prize money for some early climbing competitions.
Very good prize money. I mean, it's as far as I can work out, it was better prize money 20 years ago, 25 years ago, than it is now.
And this is what's fascinating. Do you remember how much it was for a win?
I mean, it varied, but I think it was, you know, if it was a really big comp, it could be 5 or 6 grand. If it was a World Cup or, you know, something like that, then maybe 3 grand, you know, for first place.
Which is more than
which
lots of comps
now. Which I think
is more
than they get now.
I think it's more for winning a World Cup now.
More now.
No, that was more. I think, isn't it 2000 or something?
I think it's around 2000. I don't know entirely, but like, yeah.
Not very much, I know that. And also, we used to get some support from the BMC, I think, for travel expenses to World Cup competitions. And they don't get any support now, do they?
It's just fascinating, because what's happened? Because that's 40 years of inflation on those figures as well. Why is it so much worse when the sport is so much bigger?
Yeah, I don't understand either. I
guess there's also so many more climbers
who are just willing to compete for peanuts.
Can't believe it's that. Why does the BMC not have money for the British team to help them with their travel?
Yeah, it's hard to believe that, yeah, the money going into it hasn't increased a lot in recent years.
No.
Well, I mean, I say recent years, the last 40 years. Yeah.
Did you win any of those competitions for that kind of money? Because that would have been, for a man living in a cave, this is life-changing sums.
Did I win? No, I didn't win. I got a few second places. Don't think I won any of the big ones. No. quite a bit of money. The first competition I went to, that Arco Bardonecchio one, I came second overall. And I think, I mean, I was 18 at the time. I was 19, something like that. And I think I won about £1,500, £2,000. I came third. I think I won the speed time. There was a speed timing. There was speed climbing competition. I think there was something to do with style as well. Like you did a route and you like tried to climb it really nicely and you got, you know, points for style.
Patrick
Edlonger won that. I'm sure that's right. Cause I remember everyone, I mean, like doing these fancy, it was like a really easy route.
I mean, that would be amazing. Like, I mean, obviously that's not going to catch on, but I feel like it would be so interesting. That format of competition could be really fun. I guess
climbing dressage.
Yeah, just like
it's a bit like gymnastics, though, in a way, yeah. Isn't it? Like you get marked out of 10, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
But I love that. I love the early days of competition when things are just more sort of fun. It's like people don't realise that the Olympics used to have poetry and hot air ballooning and poodle shearing in it back in the early days.
Did it?
Yeah,
I did not know that.
When the French hosted it in the 1900s, they had all sorts of fun things, including poetry is a great one.
Wow. Extreme poetry.
An Olympic poet.
Wow. On this competition vein, I got the impression like the pool of international elite climbers was obviously a lot smaller at the time. Yeah. You mentioned like Mark Le Menestral and a few people over there, and then there was like yourself and Jerry based in Sheffield. And did that like a competitive streak kind of, was that consistent throughout indoor and outdoor climbing as well? I watched Stone Love a lot when I was younger.
Thinking about that film today.
Yeah, in Cresciano.
Switzerland, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And actually, the scene I was really thinking of, I think it's a point where you injured your shoulder on that trip.
I'm injured.
Yeah, so you're like kind of...
I'm really frustrated and pissed off.
Yeah, yeah. There's some good clips, actually.
Getting burnt off by Malk.
Yeah, well, that's the bit I remember. There's a moment where they're both trying Le Pru, I think. Yeah. And Malk's Malk's doing pretty well in it. Jerry's having a hard time. And then suddenly Jerry like starts doing much better. And it feels like there's a real like kind of rivalry in the air. And I always thought it was quite funny to see like I'm sure it's friendly rivalry, but like the competitive streak come out seemed quite apparent. And I wondered if that was something that you felt generally amongst a community of elite climbers back then.
Yeah, it was competitive. It's so funny that you were thinking about that, because I was thinking about it today and I was thinking about it so much that I was thinking, I want to get the film out and have it watch it again. It was basically Jerry's, he pretty much packed in hard climbing after that trip, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he did, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. Maybe it was too competitive.
Bet. Can't be the best. I'm not going to do it. It was competitive back then, but it was a friendly competitiveness as well. You know, I mean, I've climbed quite a bit with Mount.
But you also had, you sort of, I think you described it as lovers' tiffs with Jerry over routes and things back then. It was there was an element of friends, but also rivals.
No, you're right. I'm probably glossing over it. Yeah, no, we did have some big falling outs, me and Jerry. Mainly me and Jerry. He even had me in a neck lock once. Tokyo.
Why?
Friendly rivalry?
We were playing a video game, a driving game, and we were racing each other. And he ran me off the track. And when we left the video shop, you know, I said, you know, I was like, you know, you pushed me off the track or something, and he got really angry and grabbed me and head up.
But this is why this era of climbing is just more fun to talk about, because now everyone's like, one of the criticisms that sometimes gets levied at the modern climbing scene is everyone's so afraid to say something wrong and then get cancelled, or say something wrong and fall out with someone. Whereas back in these days, you went to France, put up the hardest routes, and you called one Agincourt and the other Maginot Line, which is outrageous. But you'd never do that by today's standard. What was it that made you do that?
They were Sean, my friend Sean Miles came up with those renames. They were just a bit of humour, really.
and at least when you name it something like that, you know you've got like a month of leeway to get out the country before it gets published in all the magazines.
True, true. But then we also had the French coming over to Raven Tour, didn't they? And they soloed one of Jerry's routes.
Antoine Le Ministrel soloed Revelations. I mean, that was flipping bonkers. I mean, that's still the hardest route in the UK, and he came over and soloed it. It was crazy. They showed it to us.
That was their retaliation.
Do you remember getting any stick at the time for those route names?
No, not really. I mean, the French are a bit funny because they think that the person who puts the bolts in the route is the person who names the route. So the Maginot Line was already caught, had already been bolted. It was an open project, and it was known as Le Plafond, the roof, I think that means in roof in French. And then I renamed it that. So I think there's a bit of a funny thing. In fact, I don't know what they call it these days. Maybe they do call it Le Plafond.
Singapore 1942, or Battle of Bannockburn or something.
These historical references, they're going straight over my head.
Sorry, those are English defeats.
Yeah, okay. So
I also remember having an argument with Gibet, Jean-Baptiste Tribut, on a coach one time on the way from like the warm-up zone in a competition. I don't know which competition it was, but the warm-up zone was different to where the actual arena was, and getting into an argument with Gibet. I can't remember what it was about. I think it was about grades.
it's good to hear that grades were still a controversial thing back then.
At least that argument didn't end in a headlock. Although I kind of wish it had.
Me and Jerry are still good friends.
On the maps. Okay, yeah. And I think this is right. It was actually very shortly after you climbed Agincourt. You did Hubble just the year after, right?
Yeah, year after.
I mean, was a historical route at the time initially the first proposed 80 plus, and since has like retrospectively been upgraded and now regarded as the first 9A. But could you describe a bit of your like experience of that route? I don't actually know like whether it was like a long-standing project for you or like whether it had been tried many times by other people or what was a bit the history of the route there?
It was the Whore of Babylon. It was a Andy Pollitt route. He'd free climbed an age route at Ravens Tour. I can't remember what was the age route called, Whore of Babylon. Oh, I can't remember. It was an age route and Andy Pollitt had freed it all, bar for the first two bolts. I think he'd tried it a little bit and he thought it maybe might be possible, but it was too hard for him. And I think he must have said, oh, you should have a look at it. And I had a look at it and thought, oh, God, that seems a bit hard. I don't know that was probably 1988, because I think that's when he did his route with the 2 8 points. And I thought, oh, that's too hard. And then I think I had another couple of days on it the next year, another look at it. And then properly got stuck into it in 1990, so 2 years after Andy's route. But in fact, it actually only took me 7 days. The year I did it in 1990, it only took me 7 days to do it. So I think I'd only probably had about 4 days on it before. So it actually came together really quite quickly. But yeah, it did seem like, you know, significantly harder than something like Agincourt or any of the other hard routes down in Bukes. It is effectively a boulder problem anyway. I mean, if it was a flat landing underneath, you'd boulder it out, wouldn't you, probably?
It's generally seen as like a font 8B plus boulder into like a French 7C plus route.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So it's like, I guess, of a very different style to lots of the classic French routes as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's okay, it's Raven's Tour, so, you know, it's like polished limestone. It's like not the most sort of aesthetic to look at, but it is a pretty amazing route just because, you know, after all this time, no one's found any other holds, or, you know, there's no real tricks to it, are there? I don't know if you
I haven't been. I haven't been on it. No, I would like to.
You saving it for the Flash.
No, I am quite keen to try it a bit, but
got to put a rope on then.
Yeah. Got to put a rope on. Got to learn to clip again.
How to tie a figure of eight or bowling?
Yeah. I think I can remember. Push off some cobwebs.
You're more of a boulder, aren't you? And it's like when you find something that, you know, like that, that's just got no extra holds on it, it's quite sort of special, isn't it?
Yeah. And for something to be, tried so much, be so historical, and yet remain unchanged in method is definitely quite rare.
They have, seems like they've discovered a bit of a knee scum type thing, but I'm sure it still looks really hard.
Yeah. People say it doesn't change the grade that much with the knee bar. It's supposed to be slightly easier, but not much.
Probably depends on your knee bar skills, doesn't it, and your length of your knees and stuff. I mean, people are really good these days at knee bars. I was watching Edda. I don't know if you know Edda. Do you know Edda? Flipping, he's incredible with knee bars. I call them knee bars. It's more, you know, like a knee scum or whatever, but it's like, it's pretty amazing where he gets these things. Like, you just cannot imagine it. Even if it's just like, you know, maybe you can only take one hand off and it's only for a few seconds, you know, or, you know, because it's so strenuous and stuff. But even just to get the thing to stick, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
And three on Northern Lights, my project at Kilnsay.
Yeah. I'm always amazed like how people can be so intuitive with knee bars as well. Like if I use a knee bar, it's like a very much, it feels a bit clunky. But like some people who are really good at knee bars, it's like incorporated into the way they move. And it's incredibly fluid. And I've definitely never had anything like that.
I'm hopeless at it. I mean, it is a new school thing, though, isn't it? But I mean, Adam Andre, he climbs with two knee pads on all the time, doesn't he? It's like his knees are an extension of his hands and feet.
Do you climb with a knee bar pad at all, Ben?
No.
Have you ever climbed with a knee bar pad? No, never.
Yes, I did on Mecca when I was doing the Mecca extensions. When I sort of got started getting back into sport climbing, I climbed with one. Just the odd route where maybe there's been one, but no, hardly at all. No, they do spoil some things as well, I do think.
Yeah, because I was always just about to ask, is what do you feel about people using knee bars on historical routes, which were put up
Mecca's
before?
A classic example. You know, I did second ascent of Mecca in without a knee bar. I don't know when it was, 85, 86, something like that. And then when I started getting back into sport climbing again in 2013. I was climbing at Raymond's Tor a lot and I did a couple of the extensions there. And obviously by this stage, everyone's wearing a knee bar and they're, you know, that you're getting a no hands rest in the groove, clip a bolt off it. And there's, you know, the big controversy is that the grade's not changed. It's still saying it's OB plus. And I was like, oh. I mean, Zippy really wanted to downgrade it in the new BMC guidebook that came out a few years ago. He wanted to downgrade to AB, but I think no one would let him. But, I mean, it's a bit odd, isn't it? It's like, you know, without a knee bar and then with a knee bar. I mean, it's strenuous, but you still probably get like 20 seconds on it, building on who you are and stuff. So that's got to have an impact on the grade. But maybe it was hard 8B plus and now it's easy 8B plus. I don't know.
But yeah, no, I guess of the era. Is it something that you would sort of think it'd be better for people if the route predates knee bar pads? Would you think it would be better for people to just do it without them?
You can't, can you? I think it would, but I mean, it's just, you know, you're gonna try and do the route whichever way you can, aren't you? So you're trying to find the easiest way. So yeah, you're gonna just use a knee pad, just like I did on the extensions.
So just in, and I'm assuming that we've passed over this at some point in like the chronological order of things. You're part of a group that was probably historically quite well known for pioneering training for bouldering as many people enjoy it today. I remember it's in the real thing where Jerry talks about like how weird the concept of training for bouldering was, I think. I'm assuming at this point when you're climbing things like Hubble, which are like extremely bouldery and very physical, was that like at a point where you'd started experimenting into like the kind of board style training?
In 1989, I started climbing on like home boards things, you know, at people's cellars. Andy Pollitt had one in his garage, but it's basically just kind of going across the rafters footless on some small edges. And then I built a similar one in my cellar. And then Jerry built like a fancy one in his house. We just sort of started, training on, boards, very basic boards. It was mainly because there weren't climbing walls. I mean, I just remembered, you know, we trained all that winter, winter 89, and then came out and, did Hubble. So, yeah, maybe, I mean, obviously, yeah, must have had some help. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the...
I think it was more the fact that you could climb all the time, you know, because before then, you know, if it's raining, you know, there's no climbing walls, you're very limited to what you can do. I mean, that's one of the big differences between then and now, isn't it? It's like, you know, there's 6 climbing walls in Sheffield or something, and they're all really good. You know, there weren't any in Sheffield back then. So I think it was just, you know, that was just building our own climbing walls. And so that just allows you to climb all the time. And so you're going to get stronger, aren't you, really?
Especially winter in the UK, with the regularity of climbing, if you rely on climbing on rock, would be definitely limiting.
And did anyone have fancy sort of professionally made holds, or was it all bits of wood and
It was
banisters?
All bits, in the beginning, it was all bits of wood. Yeah, definitely. It was, yeah, I mean, Entreprise were one of the first, I think, must have been one of the first climbing wall manufacturers. So there might be some Entreprise holds, possibly. But yeah, basically wood and Entreprise holds, I guess. And then when the schoolroom opened in 93, which was about, you know, 3 years later, there was definitely more, there was more climbing hold brands around then. Not many, though, but there was a few.
And when did your climbing pivot a bit from sport climbing to going into more bouldering phase?
93, I pretty much packed in sport climbing and just went bouldering.
Do you remember why that was?
I just ran out. I'd been trying my Kilnsy project that I mentioned just a little while ago for 3 years. Started trying that in 1993. Yeah, and tried in 93, 94, 95. And spent about 30 days on it and got, well, no, actually, I didn't get that close, actually, in hindsight. But basically just, lost motivation. And I don't know, it didn't seem that much in terms of sport climbing that I wanted to do in the UK. I don't know why, because, you know, there was still a lot of good stuff to do. But, yeah, I don't know, just, yeah, kind of lost motivation for that and just seemed easier to go bouldering, really. So just started going bouldering more. Well, that was all I was doing.
And was that mostly on the grit, or was that limestone?
A mixture of limestone and grit, basically. Limestone in the Peak District, you know, like Stoney Middleton, Cressbrook, Raven's Tor, Paracels Cave, and then, the gritstone, a bit of sandstone up to the north. And there's sort of places now, but there's been so much development. I mean, now I look back and I think, oh, my God, what was I doing? You know, there was all these other places I could have been developing. I feel like missed a trick there, really. It was maybe not imaginative as it could have been, or I don't know what it was, but there's you know, a lot of stuff's been done, hasn't it? I mean, it's made, even just in the Peak District, like on our doorstep, you know, I'm always still hearing about good new stuff that's getting done. Whereas, back then, I don't know, I think we didn't make enough effort to sort of search out all this other stuff.
You're doing a lot of eliminates on the limestone back then, right? You had lots of sort of like contrivances.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was partly because we were there at Crags where we were doing, roots. Yeah, I don't know why. But it's a good point. Whereas we could have been doing like new non-eliminate stuff, couldn't we, with the amount of rock there was around.
Yeah, I do think there's like, there are certain places where that really holds a place. I feel like often for me, often climbing on kind of psychologically, I have like the equivalent in the Lake District of climbing on the Bowder Stone. It's almost crosses the balance between like outdoor climbing and you enjoy the context of being outside with your friends and you are just outdoor climbing, but there's like a, it feels like it's got a slight training based element to it as well. I almost treat it like a board. I'll have, and because there are places which I keep going back to, I'll have like certain eliminates where I'll be like, oh, that hold. And you kind of make these problems and they're like kind of little references throughout time. And it can become quite like routine, that kind of thing as well. So I think it definitely has a place, that kind of eliminate home game climbing.
Yeah, I think it does as well, actually. I think you explained it very well then. I mean, they at the schoolroom, it's like that even now. And even with the young people I see down there, you know, training on, you know, on the boards and stuff, they seem to have like want to do things a certain way.
Yeah, you don't see anyone whacking out knee bar pads. Yeah.
I think James Noble had said, I was down there the other day and there was, I can't remember who it was, one of the young strong kids down there was talking about this James Noble problem on the 50 degree board. You probably know it, but that it's quite a hard one, but it's, people have found an easier way where you can just miss a hold out, you know, to make it easier, which actually makes it easier. But they were like, you know, but you, that's not the problem. You've got to do it like he did it.
Yeah. Yes. A lot of James's ones are sequential. You have to do the sequence as he wrote it down, which is so funny.
What has he made that? Has he made that point?
Yeah. Quite a lot of James's ones. There's a sequence that you have to do because, and they might get like a sort of an 8B grade, but you'll be thinking, well, this is 7A. I could just go straight along here. And they say, well, that's not allowed. I love it. It's like on board climbing, you can get as contrived as you want because it's all training.
Yeah. I kind of like that. There's like arbitrary rules.
But then in other ways, rules that things have got a bit sloppy as well. You know, like how you get holds, you know, whether you Dunbar pinch them or whatever, or you get them underneath, or whether you crimp them and stuff. But people just find different ways of doing things, don't they?
Yeah, it's where you draw the lines to kind of do things the historical original style. Yeah, people have different criteria. But when you were building the schoolroom, obviously it's like a evolution from your like training rooms and garages and things. Where did that idea come from?
Andy Pollitt it was Andy Pollitt. He built the first one. It was his idea, but I don't know where he got it from.
Ah, okay. And then did it develop much over time? Or because, I mean, it's obviously...
It's basically a climbing wall, isn't it? I mean, my dad was a painter and he had a studio in his garden and it had like breeze block walls. And I remember nailing, I mean, he used to make the stretchers, the wooden stretchers. So there was always wood in the studio and stuff. And I remember nailing pieces of the stretchers onto the wall, you know, just like 10 of them, whatever, and then traversing back and forth on these stretchers. You know, I mean, it's a climbing wall, isn't it? It's just like you do whatever you can to, you know, to climb, I suppose, don't you? And, you know, Andy, I guess, built something in his garage because he had a garage.
Is it like a slight surprise or not that board climbing has got such a, it's got its own identity now. It's almost developed into its own sport. There are people who go board climbing more or less as their sole form of climbing, and it's funny how this trickles down, because like for a while you're only doing, you know, single pitch trad to train for the mountains, you know, and then you're doing bouldering but only to train for sport climbing, and then you're doing board climbing but only to train for bouldering, and now people are just board climbing to board climb.
Yeah, you get some full-time fingerboarders.
Yeah, that's the next step. It's the next step. But just that, I remember it being quite funny because I remember once we were having a chat at the schoolroom and people were like, oh no, you've got to do this schoolroom boulder this way. And I remember, like, I can't remember if it was me, but someone asked you, like, oh, is that's the way you've got to do it? And you're like, I don't care. And it was like, what? I sort of assumed you would care the most.
I've given up caring.
Back then, was board climbing just a means to an end?
It was. Yes, it was. Well, for most people it was, but yeah, you get certain people, don't you, that, you know, they just get sucked into that bored, and then they don't do the other stuff. Whether it's, I mean, I don't know, you know. Yeah, no, I mean, there's this guy, Andy Bowie. He's like, he got, I'd say he was a bit like that, and he got really into the ball climbing. I think, I don't know whether it was him that wrote the guidebook, actually, for the school run, but he was very funny, really strong fingers and everything. And then he got injured. But yeah, so, I don't know. It's like training, isn't it? You know, you see a lot of people training these days, don't you? Are they training for something, or are they just trying to get better? Are they... I mean, the thing is, climbing indoors is good fun, isn't it? And climbing on a board is basically, you know, a form of indoor climbing, isn't it?
So the most fun type of indoor climbing.
Okay. Like a warm, sudden rain.
Yeah. The style of training that you were doing at that time, it's developed like a real following. There are some like real diehard board fans and that kind of who follow that kind of training. So it is funny to hear you talk about it in a manner which is like, oh yeah, that was fun. because I feel like it holds so much significance for so many people, which it's quite.
It was definitely a means to an end back then.
Because then you bouldered for a long period. And I was really surprised, actually, because I was watching an old classic dosage video the other day. And it had like Sharma in Hueco. So it was Sharma in Hueco. And then suddenly it was Ben. Ben was there telling him all the beta on something which he then attempted to flash.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh wow!
Surprise!
Yes, flash Nagul. Is it Nagul?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He did a good effort.
Yeah, he did. I think he falls off quite late.
Yeah, high. He fell up, got high. Yeah, it's flipping. Yeah, it was really impressive. It's a gnarly thing. Do you know that, Aidan? Have you been to Waco?
No, I haven't been, but I do know the one.
You just eat that up. Oh my god!
It's like. Just yeah, it's small just crimps on a board.
Yeah, it's all over it. I mean, Chris, he's a big guy, isn't he? And they're gnarly flipping crimps, but DDA did a really good effort.
Yeah. I've actually never climbed him, but I have heard that he's a big bloke for
incredibly strong.
Yeah, how well he can function on small holds.
Yeah, then Adam Ondra is as well. Oh, that's what I. That was the first time I climbed him when he came to the school last year. I mean, he's a big guy with big fingers.
Yeah, I think that is the surprise when you meet Andre, is that he's just much bigger than you think he's going to be. You sort of all have the image of him as like the skinny little rake when he first started as a kid.
Probably was.
Yeah, and now it's different game. But do you remember how long you bouldered for before you took your break? Because you took a climbing hiatus, and up until then it was mostly bouldering.
Well, 94, probably from like 94 to like 2009 or something like that, 2010, I think, when I sort of stopped climbing. Well, I guess a couple of women now, it's so long ago, I'm just too old.
It's funny, isn't it? Because like, you actually ended up bouldering primarily.
15 years.
For probably longer than you... sport climbed and sport climbed,
yes I will have done
do you still consider yourself more of a sport climber than a boulderer, because that's people's sort of general assumption? I think your more famous routes are sport climbs.
I wouldn't say I don't think of myself as either more of one. I mean, I probably prefer sport climbing. If I had to pick one, I suppose I might pick sport climbing. On-site climbing, I think on-site climbing, but you know, that kind of discipline over bouldering. But I don't know, no, they're both great.
And how long was your break?
The two guys there who basically don't sport climb.
Yeah, literally, I've never sport climbed outside.
Aidan's done a few.
Yeah, I've done a few. I keep saying that I would like to do some more, but
why don't you just do some of the short ones?
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, like, I'd even like to do the longer ones. The thing is, it's not that I don't really want to. It's that I, like, keep saying that I will, but then I'm always just so busy being really content doing loads of bouldering, so I just never seem to find the time. Yeah, maybe.
Bouldering is very, I mean, it is very easy to do, isn't it, and accessible. you can do the sport climbing when you're older anyway. I mean, that is one thing with bouldering. Now, when you get into your 50s or, you know, 60s and stuff, jumping off outdoors, you know, is not very appealing.
Mm. Yeah, okay. And yeah, so...
at some point, jumping off indoors is not going to be very appealing.
Yeah, so with that 15 years, like the 15-year hiatus, did climbing just become more of a recreational thing, or did you kind of stop climbing altogether?
I probably stopped climbing in, yeah, like I think it was probably when my daughter was born, actually, so around about 2009, something like that. And then started again in 2013, I think it was.
But wasn't it seeing people sport climbing that got you excited to get back into it?
It was seeing Jordan Byes on Rain Shadow at Malham that got me kind of sort of motivated again. I think partly, you know, because I had a business that was sort of in its early years, so that was taking quite a bit of work time and focus. And then I had my daughter as well, you know, and that takes quite a bit of, you know, well, you'll know that, you know, quite a work. So it's maybe, yeah, lost the sort of focus for the climbing and stuff.
And then when you saw Jordan on Rain Shadow, were you thinking, I want to come back to climbing because I want to climb Rain Shadow? Or is this
I
just
was
like...
thinking that, yes. Specifically thinking, yeah, because I was just so inspired. I was just like, oh my God, that looks amazing. I think it was partly because he was the only person at the crag. All the crag was kind of wet, but there was just this sort of dry patch coming down the sort of section of Rain Shadow. And he was obviously super motivated, you know, because he's the only person there. And most of the crag's wet, but he can still kind of work it and stuff. And it did look incredible. But yeah, no, it was, I wanted to like come back and try and do that.
This is, I think, a fantastic story, because how old do you think you were then when you saw Jordan climbing Rain Shadow?
Oh, well, that was a couple of years probably before I did it. Yeah, I don't know. Well, I can't. Did I do it in 2015? So, yeah. Or, I don't know. Yeah, 13, 2013, 2014, something like that. No, it's 2013, yeah. I started again in 2013, I think.
So you're in your 40s. You're looking at a guy climbing a 9A in your 40s, having not climbed at all in years.
I remember saying to my wife, just as we were walking away, says, I'm sure I could do that if I applied myself to it.
Because there must be something innate.
I'm going to do it.
It's like there's still the spirit of the climber is still like innate in you, that the kind of feeling that you can overcome a challenge and that you want to take on a challenge.
Yeah.
Because in most sports, someone in their 40s who's not taken part in the sport for like 4 years or something, people would consider, no, your elite days in that sport are now over.
Yeah, well, it wasn't elite anyway, was it? Not on a world standard. I mean, it's probably quite good for someone my age, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I was going to say something, I forgot what it was. Anyway, yeah.
But like elite in that, like you'd climb 9A when in the days when you were sport climbing. I mean, it's an ambitious thing to set yourself to on the back of like a few number of years of not climbing. I think I watched an interview, you actually had to train pretty thoroughly for that, right? I was getting back into training after so much time off.
Yeah, it was okay. I mean, it was really enjoyable. I mean, I spent quite a lot of time at Ravens Tor, had the schoolroom. Yeah, no, it was good fun. I mean, I'm incredibly lucky because my sort of physique's not really changed over the years. I'm still the sort of same weight as I was 20 years ago and everything, and I've been incredibly lucky with injuries and everything. So, and yeah, my fingers are naturally strong. It wasn't too bad getting back into shape, really. But yeah, I remember going to, I think the first route I redpointed was this route at Ravenstor. It's like an extension of Chimes of Freedom. It's like an 8B, like an endurance-y thing. That was like my first route back, kind of redpointing. I like working it and then trying to redpoint it. And I was just trying to sort of work through the grades, really get my strength back up and everything. So, and yeah, no, it went all right, really.
Yeah. You've lived in Sheffield throughout that time. And I guess somewhat had your foot in the door with the climbing community in that you were like Moon was like very integrated into the climb community as well. But was it quite nice to like come back to climbing for the sake of like the sociable element of it as well? Like, I guess.
Yeah, no, it was really nice. Yeah. And, you know, I was meeting new people as well in a way, because, you know, most of my generation had sort of stopped climbing and stuff. So it was a different sort of group of people that I was climbing with and everything. And no, I could see that there's, you know, there's a really good scene out there. Maybe that was one of the reasons maybe why I sort of stopped sport climbing, is because maybe the people that I had been sport climbing with had sort of drifted away or done other things or something. I don't know. But it's important to have the right people around you, isn't it? Or to, you know, can help motivate you, can't they? And yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it.
And how long did it take you then to do it, to do Rain Shadow?
That's a good question. I think it took about 19 days or something. But I did it the first season I started trying it. I mean, I went up there with Simon Lee in February 2015, and I was going to get on an 80 plus or something. I can't remember what it was, what route I was going to get. I thought I'll get on something easier to start off with. And I was saying this to Simon. He goes, "Oh, no, just get straight on it." So I was like, "Oh, all right then." And so, yeah, I just got on it that first day. And then Simon was trying. I can't remember what route he's trying, consenting adults. So we were basically going up there a lot. Austrian Oak, that was it, I think. And so we were going up there a lot over a sort of basically 2 month period or something, pretty much April, May, 3 month period. Just basically was getting further and further as it went on. I mean, it goes up a sort of classic 8A route for about 10 meters. Then you've got like a Fonte 8A plus. V11 boulder problem through a roof. It's quite a long boulder problem. It probably takes about 45 seconds to climb something steep. And then you go into like a sort of probably a 10, 15 meter route 8B or something like that. And I think I did, so I was just basically focusing on the boulder problem. And I think I did the boulder problem. I think I did the boulder problem in a one or after 3 days or something. And then it was just a question of keep practicing the boulder problem, figuring out the top section, getting rain dogs wired. It was a really enjoyable process. My progress was mainly sort of whatever you call it when it's going up.
Yeah, pretty linear.
Except for just near the end where I fell off like second to last move or something. Which I really, it's not really a hard move. I totally blew it mentally. Fumbled this flipping hole. It was terrible. so gutted. You're on the undercuts. You're right up there, really near the beach. Basically, one move where you just got to sort of slap for this kind of layaway. And I felt good, you know. And I just, I was like, I've come up short.
when there's all the time to be like, oh, I feel good. The hole's just there, and like you fumble it.
It's funny how often that story does come with a bit of an inner monologue of like, yes, I've done it. I'm going to do it. It's over. And then you blow it. It's like that feeling of, oh God, I'm going to do it, takes you out of your flow. And then you just start climbing badly without realizing.
Yeah, but do you get that bouldering? I mean, do you get it much bouldering?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I think I work hard to try and not get it.
Maybe.
If it's a really short boulder and it's only like over in a blink of an eye, then sometimes it's not such a thing. But I definitely get it where like if there's like, especially if there's like a crux or like a section which I haven't gone through, and still pretty challenging climbing afterwards. I've definitely been in a situation where I've been like, I've gotten through that bit and like, or there'll be like certain bits on climbs where I'll be like, oh, okay, if I get through that section, it's only if I fluff up that I'll fall off the rest of it. And this will be when I'm not climbing. I'll just be like, okay, so I'm going to rehearse it and get it really dialed. And so like, I know that that's not going to be a problem. Like it's well rehearsed. And then there's definitely been times in the past where I've like had the thought process. I get through the crux and I'm like, better not mess this up. And then tense up a lot. And you kind of go from climbing really well and like, you know, you're moving well because you've gotten through the bit that you've never gotten through before, mm-hmm. to just like seizing up. And yeah, that's sometimes not that helpful, but I've always thought, I've never really delved so much into sport climbing, but
think that's the big difference.
You've got to just sustain that mental state for so much longer, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's very difficult. The pressure's much higher as well, because you've invested so much more. You've it's probably might have taken you longer to get to the crag. You know, you've got to go through this long-winded warm-up process. You've got to work the route. You know, the route's 10 meters, 15, 20, 30, 40 meters. You know, it's incredibly time-consuming, isn't it? So that's like creating pressure, which, you know, you don't get that with bouldering, which is one of the attractions with bouldering, isn't it? You know,
you can have way more goes in a session, which is
way
nice.
More goes. You know, you can do it on your own.
It's definitely dependent on far fewer factors, isn't it?
I mean, I think that's one reason why people get like sucked into boards and stuff and training, because it's kind of easier just to train and not actually have to sort of confront what you've got to actually do out of the crowd.
That's quite an interesting idea, whether like, yeah, a bit of it is a bit of failure.
Yeah, I think it is.
I mean, outdoor climbing in general, route climbing or bouldering alike, you can rock up and it just be like terrible conditions and you don't really get a good session in. But then, like you say, if you're on a route and you've put a load of effort into this route and your foot blows on the last move, like, and you're boxed out of your mind and you can't recover for another go, then yeah, you've sunk like a lot of energy into that. Whereas if you go down to your local boardroom, it's lower consequence.
Yeah, definitely. Which is why it's good fun as well.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe nice to have. Do you ever do much work on your head game on routes? Was it ever active the way and you prepare for it? Because I know you used to do like a lot of routes outside to develop endurance and stuff, didn't you? Was that all for the physicality of like getting pumped and like gaining endurance, or like was there an element of practicing your mindset as well when you were doing those kind of things?
I worked on sort of visualization, you know, at home, you know, just sort of lying down and stuff, and at the crag, you know, practice, you know, trying to picture climbing routes and everything. But I mean, I wouldn't say that I've mastered it or anything like that. I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has.
No, I mean, I remember, I think it might have been the day before I did Rain Shadow, I was watching the film, Chris Sharma film on Realization at Seyouz, you know, because he put a lot of time into that as well. You know, and yeah, he was talking about the mental side of things and saying how difficult it was and everything. And, you know, you try lots of different things and everything. I mean, I remember in that film, on one of his attempts, he's doing yoga, you know, he's chanting to himself at one of the rest points, you know.
When he's climbing.
Yeah, when he was climbing, yeah. Because that's like, I don't know how long the route is. It's probably 45, 50 meters, I don't know. But it's basically, you know, you do like an 8C, I don't know if it's an 8C, I think you do an 8C plus, long 8C plus into like a really hard boulder problem. But there's like there's a rest at like a sort of porthole, I think it is. And he was resting at a porthole and he was chanting and stuff. He was trying everything. He kept falling off. Oh, God, it's painful.
Ran every trick in the book.
So after doing Rain Shadow, did you ever have a feeling of like, right, I'm done again, I'm going to move away from climbing? Or was that just doing Rain Shadow was more just like, no, this has just got me back into it?
No, I was just back into it. And then I was like, flipping out. I wonder if I can do my Kilnsy project. So I started trying the Kilnsy project, Steve McClure's route.
So this is Northern Lights?
Northern Lights, yeah, exactly.
This is the same route that you tried
1993 and 1994 and 1995. Yes, I've spent flipping a lot of days on that route.
And then you're trying
I thought I'd spent a lot of days back then. I think I've got them all in my diary, those. And I thought that was like about 30 days. I was like, flipping, I spent a lot of days then. I've spent way more than that since then. The second time around trying to do it.
And so there you were trying it sort of over 15 years later. Or about 15 years later, I suppose.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, about 15 years later. Yeah. It was only 15 years later. I didn't see so much, but yeah. Yes.
And you got very close.
Got really close. Oh, my God. For a couple of days, I was like, I'm going to do this. And then I didn't.
How close to the top was your best go?
Oh, like 3 meters. like a boulder problem, a 7A plus boulder problem, 7A plus boulder problem away. No, it's probably not 7A plus. Probably is harder than that. Probably 7B, 7B plus, I don't know. But it's like a, you know, 8 moves or something. So it's not like it's really hard boulder problem.
Close enough to be tantalizing.
Yeah.
And did you just run out of time that season? Did it get wet? Or
I blame conditions. In fact, I think, well, obviously if I was better, I would have done it. But, you know, when it's, I mean, you're the same for, you know, for anyone basically who's trying to do something at their limit, you need everything, you need the conditions to be absolutely perfect, you know, for lots and lots of days, basically, don't you? Because people do take a long time to do their, you know, when they're trying to do something at a limit, don't they? And so, yeah, I just think I just didn't get the conditions consistently enough there.
Mm.
I do think I would have done it if I had, like, consistently good conditions. But,
is it fair to say that will be your longest project by days?
More than 100 days on it. I mean, I was watching Nale's film the other day, you know, of his 9A, what's it called?
Bird of Dreams, yeah.
Yeah, Bird of Dreams films. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
The one with the weird rolling dice one.
Yes, yeah. Well, yes. I watched it when it came out. I purchased it when it came out and I thought it was great. And then I watched it twice just recently because I wanted to share it to a couple of friends. It's really good. But yeah, because obviously one of the big things in that is like how many seasons he spent trying it and how many days. And I was like, flipping out, that's nothing.
Yeah. Because the big theme of that is, well, I guess it's kind of, I think that like there's an analogy there in that like the rolling the dice, it was kind of like aligning the conditions with when you're in good shape, getting everything on the right day. But definitely the theme of the film was that like it was taking a really long time for him to do it. But was it, I think it was like 80 day or 90 sessions or something. I can't remember. It might even have been a bit less than that.
I think it was like, I think it was maybe 30 or something.
Oh, right. Okay.
Or maybe I'm wrong.
Way less than that.
It was definitely less than I've spent on Northern Lights. So I remember thinking that, but,
yeah, he's only just getting started.
I think he said like how long that took him compared to the hardest thing he'd done before that. There was a big difference, wasn't there? I think he said something like, I don't know what the hard problem was that he'd just done before that. I think he said it took him about 9 days or something. And obviously, yeah, this, whatever it was, 30, 40 days is a lot more. But I mean, yeah. I mean, what's the longest you've spent on anything?
I think now, there's a project I've been trying in Switzerland, which I've probably spent the most days on. I generally haven't done... I've got a local project
that... How many, though? Are you talking 10, 20?
Probably 20. 20 plus.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got a local project, which I think I put about 20 days into last summer. So I was trying that a lot. Because it's really near my house, but I only found it at the start of last summer. So I think that'll fast overtake everything. It's like, I guess it's just a home project, right? That makes such a difference. You can just like try it and like still incorporate into your everyday life. Whereas when you're abroad, it is a bit more of a commitment.
How long is it?
The boulder problem at home.
Yeah.
I'd say 6 moves before you really ought not fall off. And then 8 moves before you definitely shouldn't fall off.
It's got a few moves then, isn't it?
Punchy, but not like just a couple of moves.
How long do you try that for in a session?
It depends initially when I was trying it. I think it took me about 10 days to actually do all the moves. And so many of it was just changing methods all the time. So like the first few days were very much like pulling on and slapping at the next hold kind of thing. And then I guess I'd rest less. And it was kind of quite hard to tell how much climbing I was actually doing. But then I was like starting the last few sessions, I was starting to give it tries from the start and could maybe have, I'd probably have like 2 or 3 hours on it, but quite long rest. But I'd always like finish. It's quite interesting in that like, it's really crimpy, but the edges are pretty flat, so you don't really lose that much skin unless you like were to fire off it. But it's not so skin intensive, but your fingers just tire out pretty quickly.
Well, that sounds great. Yeah, because all of these hard things do, well, I don't know, yeah, seem quite skin intensive. Or certainly Bird of the Dreams, that's just gnarly film. Every time he falls off, the first thing he does, he looks at his fingers.
Yeah. I can relate to that.
I don't think there's anyone else who looks at their fingers as quickly as Aiden does. Aiden's very quick to look at his fingers when he falls off.
Before I've hit the mat.
Oh, in the ground. Straight up. I don't care about what else hurts when I hit the ground. We've got this. We've got a Patreon for the podcast, Ben, and people on there know who's coming up, and they ask questions. And the question I was least surprised, I think, to see coming up there was people wanted to know: do you think you'll ever get back on Northern Lights?
I don't think I will. I don't think I will. No, unfortunately, I think I've blown it. I think that ship has sailed. Unfortunately,
but you do still climb.
I do still climb,
and you still climb quite a lot on boards. Felt like you were climbing well, do you think you could ever be tempted just to go back and have a quick tester?
I could be. Yeah. Maybe if life circumstances change a bit or something. Yeah, maybe. Never say never. Definitely.
Yeah, I believe it.
I think it would be. I think it would be one of the biggest ever UK news stories if you went back and did that.
Yeah, it's just cannot imagine what it'd feel like to clip that belay.
I need to
get some coaching lessons from Edda about Nibar. But that's a funny one, actually, because I kind of feel, I mean, just listening to you talking about your boulder problem project, where you're saying you spend your time at the beginning working on sequences, working out sequences and everything. I mean, that's really hard, isn't it? Figuring out how to do things. Well, especially on your own, I suppose, being with people, you know, figuring out what sequence is best and everything, and committing to it and everything. I don't know. It's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, I've seen that a little with people who are more sport climbing specialists, and like I've compared like my approach to things. Like the little sport climbing that I've done in more recent years, I was like in Spain very briefly at the end of this summer and was doing some sport climbing, and much easier sport climbing. But the thing that I was really noticed the difference with bouldering was like I was climbing with this guy, Seb Berth, basically, it was like, it's really unnatural for me to try a move and not refine it so much. He would try a move and be like, make a judgment of whether he'd like understood that move enough. And his threshold for that would be way lower than mine. Definitely like representing a bouldering specialist. I wouldn't be satisfied with a move until I'd like tried it and rehearsed it way more times. And I kind of understood what it was about that move that means that I wouldn't fall off it. And I wonder if that's like quite like a, I think because there's so many moves when you're sport climbing, I was basically like, wow, okay, if I go into the detail of understanding a move that I would on a 6 or 8 move boulder on a 30, 40 meter route, there's absolutely no way I can remember all of that unless you spend. But even then, you just can't retain all of that information. Because I feel like with sport climbing, there's always a balance, right? Of you spend a period of time just sitting on a rope, trying the moves. And like even a move that you can do, you have to refine it until it's as efficient as you think you can get it. But then there's a point where you're like, okay, yeah, I'm just going to commit to this, and you're giving it tries. And I guess in the times where you're giving it tries, you're probably not learning anything too nuanced about the individual moves.
I mean, that's like you're deciding how much time you're going to put into the route, aren't you? How much time have you got to rehearse those moves and refine those moves and everything? It depends how quickly you want to do that route, doesn't it? I suppose it depends on the difficulty of the route, doesn't it? And then how much time you've got. I mean, if it's right at your limit, then you've got to refine. You're going to have to refine the hell out of it, aren't you? and you probably keep working it, you know, even up until you're red pointing it and stuff, and you start red pointing it, and then you stop red pointing it, and then you start again and everything. But on easier stuff, yeah, it's like, as you say, you know, how many times you have to do a move before you're like, okay, I can do that. I think that's one of the things I like about sport climbing.
Yeah, it's like a tactical decision to make in there as well, isn't there? It's like, yeah, at what point do you like, okay, I just commit to this. And yeah, you also try and like understand how a move would feel having done the rest of the route, kind of thing.
Yeah, my memory is terrible for pin work. I mean, I do need to do things a lot of times to drill them into my brain. Yeah. I was never great at it, even worse now that I'm older.
So we spent some time talking about Northern Lights, probably the route that you maybe, probably fair to say that's the route. If you could have done one more route, it would probably be that one. but rather than dwelling on the negative, do you have a route that is like a particular favorite? Or Boulder or any climbing achievement?
I'm pretty fond of Voyager because that was probably the hardest boulder prom I did. And it's just a sort of standout line and everything. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with that.
And you were 40 when you did it.
And I was 40, yeah.
So hardest boulder at 40 there for people at home.
Which we are seeing more examples of as well, like Dave Graham's been climbing harder than he has done.
40 now.
I'm going to say...
He's got to 40, be more than 40. I'm going to say...
43, I think.
Okay.
42 or 43, I reckon. Maybe that's...
Yeah, well, I'm going to be 60 in 2 years' time.
So, perfect time for you to get back on Northern Lights.
What do I do when I'm 60?
Yeah, then nobody's got any excuses.
But that's another question that I predicted coming up quite a lot on the Patreon, which is that, do you have any tips for longevity in climbing or for training for the over 50s, say?
Yeah, well, I already said that I do feel like I'm very lucky and fortunate in that my sort of weight hasn't fluctuated, and I seem to be, never seem to get injured very often. But no, I mean, I just think it's like with anything, it's just being consistent. It's like you've got to do it regularly, even if it's just a little bit, you've got to just keep doing it. Otherwise, you're going to lose it, you know. So even when I packed in climbing, for those years, when I say I packed in climbing, I probably still climbed once a month or something. Now, that's not enough, really. But I think you've got to be, even those times when you're not motivated, you've got to try and make the effort and do something, you know. And if you want to progress, you probably need to be doing something 3 times a week. Well, okay, when you're 50, you're not going to progress. But if you want to slow the decline, you've probably got to be doing sort of 3 times a week. Yeah, I mean... Yes. Does that answer the question?
Sure. Yeah. I just asked the questions. I don't grade them.
I think weight training as well. I think weight training.
Oh, okay.
If they're asking about older people, when you're older, it's just being consistent, doing it regularly. And I think focus on strength. That's what I'm telling everyone who's older, because that's the main thing that declines when you get older. That's what I've noticed, is my strength is declining, even over the last sort of 3 years or something, whereas my endurance, I feel like that just keeps getting better, but my strength's definitely declining. And you know, when I look in the mirror and stuff, I look at myself, my body's, you know, just doesn't have the muscles it used to have. So I do think any time, you know, I'm talking specifically about, you know, older climbers, you know, in their 50s or whatever, I think everyone's got limited amount of time for training. So when you, for someone in, you know, those ages, I think they want to focus on strength. I do. Yeah.
Is that something you train in, like in a climbing scenario?
Lots of bouldering.
One of the questions that I most wanted to ask you was that, obviously, in your time climbing, the culture of climbing has changed almost unrecognizably, but do you still think there is more parts of it that are still the same? Do you still see a lot that you identify with that just seem to be kind of eternal through climbing? Or do you think it's Almost, yeah. Or has it just changed almost unrecognizably?
I think it's the same. I mean, the social thing's just a massive part of it. That's, you know, no, in some ways it hasn't really changed. You know, there's still a big, you know, the social thing is a big thing. There's probably more indoor climbers than outdoor climbers now, aren't there? So I suppose that's sort of the big difference, really. But indoor climbing, you know, has a lot of the sort of attributes of outdoor climbing, you know, the sort of the physical nature of it, how it's a very sociable sport.
And do you think if you were getting into climbing now, say as a young person at today's, say you'd started climbing now, you're in today's era, do you think your mentality would have got you sucked into the competition side, or do you think you would always have been driven to be outside?
It's a good question. That I think, well, no, I probably would have been driven to the competitions. I mean, I started climbing outside, so I knew about outdoor climbing. Now, I suppose, if you start indoors, are you going to know about outdoor climbing? I mean, what do you think? I don't know.
I don't think it's as enticing as it once was. I think people like watching people climbing outside. But if you talk to many people who've got like popular YouTube channels, often they'll say it's the indoor content that does better. People seem to prefer to watch indoor climbing. So I'm guessing they must be aspiring more towards indoor climbing.
But isn't that because there's more indoor climbers than there are outdoor climbers? So the indoor stuff's going to get more views.
Yeah, but I thought perhaps it shows that people who are indoor climbing are still more interested in indoor climbing. It's like they're just not as interested in outdoor climbing as they are indoor climbing.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's harder to go outdoors, isn't it? I mean, certainly if you want to go trad climbing, if you want to go from bouldering in a gym to trad climbing, that's a pretty big step, isn't it? Mm. If you want to go bouldering in a gym to sport climbing, that's a reasonable step. Bouldering indoors to bouldering outdoors, that's sort of doable. But yeah, it's very different climbing outdoors, isn't it? You know, it's more complicated, it's more dangerous, there's more to learn and everything. So it's just harder to do. And you need more time to do it. You know, that's one of the attractions with indoor climbing, isn't it? Climbing on a board is very time efficient. You know, you can get a lot done in like an hour and a half, really.
Yeah. And you can get like that sociable side of climbing we've been talking about. You can get that, you can kind of get that fix in a board session.
I had another question that I really wanted to ask, which was that I know when Sharma once had this moment that he spoke about with Ondra, where Ondra was so good and so amazing that he thought, right, this is like a passing of the torch moment. I am not the best climber in the world anymore. This guy is. Did you ever have that? And if you did, can you remember who it was that had gave you the feeling of like, right, there's a new generation?
I don't think I had that kind of thing, really.
Because it hasn't happened.
It just hasn't happened. I mean, that was this. I remember that. It was a sort of specific moment, wasn't it? They were trying. Was it the Jura Jura, maybe?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, and they're trying it together, aren't they? And Adam's pretty young at the time.
And then Adam still does it first, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I've looked at, you know, I've seen certain climbers. I mean, I remember seeing Aidan, the first time I ever saw Aidan, you know, was on a moonboard burning off Alex Magus. And I was like, oh my, I mean, that was probably 2016. So that's for what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was at Kendall Mountain Festival, wasn't it?
Yeah, Kendall Mountain Festival.
Yeah, that was the first iteration of the moonboard, right?
No, it wasn't. No, there were older ones. You used to have to download a PDF, and you just had the original yellow ones. Yeah.
There was lots of setups before that, but yeah, they were all on a website, and yeah, as Sam said, you need to print off PDFs and stuff.
So that was the first iteration of the LED'd one.
Exactly. Yeah, of the new sort of system with an app and LEDs. Yeah.
As it became modern. Well,
I remember thinking, flipping out, you'd be, this guy's strong. Look at you.
No, I do. I remember that session well, actually. I got my embarrassingly named boulder problem. It haunts me every day.
I can imagine her line.
Swordfish. But that I thought it'd be nice to talk about as well, because there's obviously the new moon board setup coming this year, but also one that, well, Sam set it, helped set it. And I recently climbed on it at the schoolroom as well. I think there's, are there only two? There's only two at the moment, right?
Yeah, yours, schoolroom and ravioli.
Yeah.
One in Germany. There's one in Germany as well. There's three.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, there's three.
Oh, that makes for another credible setter.
Yeah, who's managed to wangle one in Germany?
Well, I did a trade show. I did Halls and Walls in February, and we had a freestanding moon board there with the 2024 setup, and this gym in, I can't remember where they are now. One of the big cities bought it from at the show. They bought it at the show. So we, yeah, they've got one. Mm-hmm. So there will be some genuine problems on there.
Ah, okay. Yeah. 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 Cause when I had a session with Sam, we were like,
I mean, there's loads of problems on there already, aren't there?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a session with Sam and then Dave as well. And so like, but there's quite a few people in the schoolroom who are adding problems to it as well.
Yes.
But yeah, is that, have you climbed on it much?
Did you enjoy yourself?
Yeah, I did actually. I thought it was because there's obviously there's a new PE hold, which are like new shaped. I couldn't. They're like just like the blue shapes, which are much comfier and much worse than they look.
Yeah.
They're quite slopey, but my overall impression was I definitely thought it was of a fun style and also quite interesting. Like the first time I was on it with Sam, going through boulders that were already made up, someone Sam had done, and then someone ravioli. Ravioli, and then I think I made one up then as well, and then I was climbing on it with Dave, and we kind of were just like experimenting with different styles, and there's a lot of flexibility in it. I had a really good time, and it got pretty wrecked on it. It feels quite physical, I think, because I'm used to like, and my board at home is steeper as well, and like I generally have just a lot of very small holds, which I have most people wouldn't enjoy climbing on and has no place in like a commercial set, that it was like it was a fun way to kind of make very physical boulders.
Yeah. Yeah. More.
But I enjoyed it. I thought it was probably my favorite set yet.
Good. Yeah. No, I've had some good sessions on it over the past few months. So, you know, I really like it as well. Yeah, I think it's different, isn't it? It's different to the other sets, definitely.
Did it surprise you, Ben, how hard it is as a set?
How hard is a set?
Because when I was setting it, you know, it's the first time I'd properly held the holds and putting them up. I was a bit like, I think this is going to be at its best in the lower grades. Yes. But now since climbing on it, it's actually much harder than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. It didn't surprise me. No, I mean, I thought it'd be hard. But yes, I don't know. Yeah, we've got to get this. A few people have said about the grades. I mean, there's no benchmarks on there yet, so we've got to bloody get that right. Some of the people were saying the grades seem quite tough again, which I don't know.
That'll be forever.
I don't want it tougher than, I mean, basically every setup's got, the grades have got tougher and tougher. We don't want that trend continuing.
Yeah, decimate people's egos.
Come back down to the 2016 kind of sort of grading scale. Tough but fair.
Tough but fair, harsh but fair. But it was funny, wasn't it? Because firstly, because it's an interesting point about social media, it seemed like you were a bit surprised when you first put a picture of it on the moon climbing account, how much disparaging comments you received.
Oh my God. It was like, yeah, I posted something after that show in Germany. And yeah, there was like, I mean, there was a lot of positive comments, but there were quite a few negative comments, but they were just like, they were just uninformed, you know, ignorant comments. They really were, you know, they couldn't possibly know from a photo, you know, what the holes were like or how it climbed or anything. I mean, there's quite a few people making comparisons with Kilter. I mean, I just don't know why. I mean, I just don't see what the comparison is really, unless it was the colour of the holes or something. I don't know. But, you know, I don't think the holes are like kilter. I mean, a lot of people say that Colton and a kilter are all the same and there's lots of drugs on it. And certainly that's not the case on this setup. You know, it's got a mixture of wood, it's got a mixture of resin.
That is a point that I thought it was nice to see PE back in training setups.
Yes.
Like the texture of the blue holds, I prefer so much over PU kind of stuff. So
yeah, I mean, well, you could see that on the post. I don't think not many people know the sort of difference between PE and PU and stuff. I mean, a big pro for people who buy a 2024 moonboard setup is those holds are not going to polish. I mean, they'll last 20, 30 years. You know, the holds on the schoolroom 50-degree board, you know, they're polyester and they're exactly the same texture now as they were back in the 90s. So that's a really big pro. You just got to handle them carefully because they're not as strong as plastic holds. You know, so I worry a little bit about whether we're going to get breakages and stuff. You know, we've tried to sort out the packaging on the holds to make sure that they're safe in transit and stuff. But even if when you're setting, if you drop a polyester hold onto a concrete floor or onto another hole, it can chip or possibly break. So you do have to be careful. I mean, I think there's plenty of hold brands out there. Core Climbing, I mean, they make all their holds in polyester, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. No, there are definitely some companies that are sticking with it, which I always appreciate.
Yeah, it's better texture to climb on and better to train on over long periods of time for the polish reason. But the reason why it is prone to chipping is also because one of the things that sets this set so apart is that these ones, they really taper towards the edges. There's a lot of tapered edges on this set, which means the footholds are worse. It's really easy on this set to climb stuff with really bad footholds, whereas on every previous moon set, they tend to be, maybe, you know, they're not all great handholds, but they tend to be great footholds.
Yeah.
Which means that moon climbing has developed this kind of slightly funny one-handed style in the hard grades, where you kind of end up, the movement ends up being quite confusing, and the foot to make it hard has to be in kind of the wrong place. And to make it hard, you've normally only got one hand or one very dominant hand. And I think that style is going to be completely different. That style is going to be gone on this set because I think this one's much easier to set kind of more conventional hard climbs on because the feet holds could be much worse.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's a really good point. I mean, yeah, the foot holds are bad and it is very different to the other setups and stuff. I mean, there's pros and cons, aren't there, to both styles, really. I think you've got to be better with your feet, cleverer with your feet and stuff on this new setup and everything.
Yeah, like interesting. That was one of my takeaways. I thought the physicalities of it would likely translate well to rock climbing. And that is with the bad feet, like you were saying, Sam, the way you can make boulders, you can make them quite like body tensiony and like quite like technical, still on physical terrain, which I thought is probably quite relevant.
Yeah, well, we've tried to, you know, with the help of Sam as well, with your help, Sam, we tried to sort of make the system as sort of flexible as possible. So, you know, you can be as creative, you know, get more options and stuff and allow people to be more creative and everything with setting and stuff. So I think we've managed to do.
Yeah.
You're never going to please everyone.
No, you're never going to please everyone.
The thing is, I don't think there is a perfect board, you know. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, the moon board's great and everything, but I don't just climb on the moon board. You know, every board's different, aren't they? I mean, it's like every moon board setup's different, but, you know, and then the 50-degree board at school is different to the 2016 moon board, and then the splat board's different. They're all different styles, and like, variety is just so important, really, for making you a better climber, I think. Doing lots of different moves, different styles all the time. I mean, it's hard to do, but I do think that's like, if you could do that, then you're going to be a really good climber, aren't you?
Yeah. I was the only other thing that you see quite a lot in the comments was that a lot of people thinking that the holds all look like jugs. And I just implore those people, just try it first before you make that comment.
Barely any jugs.
There were a few more than it was if you'd stuck with my original setup, Ben. We were forced to move a couple of the jugs that I'd shunted to the side into the middle. But I'd be interested to talk a little bit about Running Moon, the brand. When did you start that?
2002. So, yeah, 21 years ago, amazingly. Can't believe it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did you transition from being a fully professional climber to fully running Moon? So sort of your sort of financial support went from being professional climber to Moon climbing?
Yes, more or less. I set up another company called S7 before Moon in 1997, when I was still kind of sponsored, actually. I still had a couple of sponsors, DMM and Mammoth and Boreal. And then I set up S7, and it started to conflict with DMM a bit. And so I ended up losing the DMM contract and then just focusing more on the business. And then I ended up selling that to an American company called Pusher. I mean, S7 was a tiny company. I sold it for pennies, you know. And then I went over there and helped to try and sort of work with them on it, but it all went wrong, and ended up sort of losing the company and coming back to the UK. And that's when I started up Moon, which was, 21 years ago. So, yeah, it was, S7 was like a sort of trial run a company thing. I learned a lot from that. It was good, really.
And how have you found running a company? Because it's very difficult.
It is very difficult. I do enjoy it. I mean, you know, you have ups and downs, like with anything. But no, I do enjoy it. I like this sort of creative side of sort of products, designing products and getting them manufactured and everything. I mean, I enjoy it. And I've got a good team now. But I think, in the early days, you know, which I touched on earlier, one of the reasons probably why I stopped climbing is because I just didn't have the time, because I really was just doing everything, you know, designing the stuff, you know, getting it manufactured, then unpacking it, you know, bringing it into the warehouse, unpacking it, packing the orders, everything. I mean, I've stuffed thousands of pads in my time. so I know the business like from, you know, through all the different processes and everything, but it's been enjoyable. I've learned a hell of a lot. I mean, yeah.
Did you mostly start with pads as well? Well, I'm just, because you did, and you did Voyager in 2005, didn't you? So that was like kind of probably in the crazy spell of the beginnings of Moon as well, I imagine.
Yes. Yeah, it was. It was a couple, 2 or 3 years into it. Well, pads and clothing, short pads, really. Mm. Because I've learned a lot from the previous brand, S7. But yeah, when I first started S7, that was, I think it was a crash pad and a set of holds. And that was it. But yeah, with Moon, I sort of started that with sort of fairly full range of products.
Mm. And how do you find being a sort of manager, managing people?
It's hard. I don't think I'm very good at it, to be honest.
No, me neither.
I try my best.
It's funny because it's something that you never really think of when you're starting a business. You never really think, what if I really struggle to manage people? You don't think that that's going to happen. And actually, as it turns out, some people just aren't very good managers.
Yeah. Well, I'd put myself in that category. But yeah, you just got to sort of do your best, don't you?
Because one of the questions we had on the Patreon was something that I actually have thought of in the past, is that someone had pointed out that Moon athletes, so people that you sponsor, don't do a great deal of social media and posting, and in general but in general, is that you don't seem to ask a great deal of your sponsored athletes. Is that partly because you remember what it was like to be one?
You're throwing them all under the bus, Sam.
I'm saying it's asked much of them.
They're all slacking.
Well, some of them.
I'll be having words with Ollie, the team manager. No, but you're right. I mean, I don't like to push people. Yeah, I don't want to push people to do things they don't want to do anyway. You know, not just if they're a Moon athlete, but anyone, you know. I mean, I sometimes wonder if I should be more pushy.
But that's the funny thing, isn't it? It's one thing to sometimes wonder, but it's another thing to actually then become that person.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you just you are just who you are.
Well, I think you're quite a nice boss, just judging by how reluctant you are to get the app development team to do more work.
Lenient.
I'm too soft, aren't I? That's the problem.
I sort of say things to Ben like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if you could set higher than the sixth row of the mood board? And I get a reply, oh, I can't ask the app development people to do that. It's too much work. Surely that's their problem, Ben.
Well, I mean, the whole tech side of things, that is, well, you asked me about how do I find running a business. I mean, the IT side of things, I hate. And it just seems like as the years go by, IT just becomes more and more of a thing. And it's like, you know, I spend a lot of money on IT these days. And I'm like, I never used to spend this money on IT. What's changed? You know, why? I find it really frustrating. I mean, okay, I can understand. I've got an app, so that requires, you know, programming, and I've got a website, and that requires programming and everything. But oh my God, I thought, you know, technology was supposed to make our lives easier, but, you know, sometimes it seems like it makes it harder. When you ask to do like add a feature to the app, I'm like, I know how difficult these things are.
Yeah.
And how much money they cost.
Yeah, there's a kind
of slow the whole process down. I mean, I can see how these big government projects run over budget.
Yes. Wow. There's loads of reasons for that. Our government's inability to run big projects is infuriating.
I mean, I watched that ITV documentary about the Horizon, the post office scandal with IT system. I mean, I don't know if you've got foreign people from overseas listening to this, it might not mean anything to them. But I mean, that when I watched that, I was just like, I mean, you just can't believe it.
Yeah, so, and our like reliance on it as well, like inability to question that it could be wrong.
It was wrong.
Yeah. I think the best way to explain it for people listening from overseas is that the Chinese now use the UK as a teachable moment of how not to do things, how not to do big infrastructure. They don't be like the UK is how they teach it now, apparently.
Do they?
Yeah, because we're so inept at big things. Like HS2 is a good example. We just cannot.
Can't really do anything.
No, we get so crippled under bureaucracy, it goes on forever, that nothing actually ever gets done.
You look at the Victorians, I mean, they were just incredible at it. I mean,
yeah.
We're basically, the infrastructure of this country is Victorian, and it's still running 150 years on. Not very good, but I mean, that's a testament to how good the Victorians were, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Even with the... Yeah.
Sentences that I didn't think would come up in my Ben Moon interview. Let's talk about Victorian trains a bit more. We should try and at least cover a couple of extra Patreon questions before we wrap up, even though we do try and keep it to 2 hours-ish.
Yeah, sure, far away.
Oh, it's good. Have you ever considered doing a special edition of the moon board that's an exact replica of the original school board?
Yes. You mean do you think they mean the 50-degree board?
Yeah, the 50-degree board, yeah.
I have thought about doing that, actually, yeah. 3D scanning it.
Yeah, I guess that's the way...
It's really expensive, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the only alternative is to go searching for the identical banisters and things. It'd be quite hard work.
That's what people have also been saying on the Patreon, is the irony of trying to, of all the tech it would take to 3D scan something which has got bits of banister that came out of a skip 30 years ago.
Pretty crazy that you could, you know, if you had the money, you know, if you had the money that you could do that, you could 3D scan it and build it, couldn't you?
3D print the whole thing.
Didn't you scan something and...
Yeah, the holds on Burden of Dreams, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was that, yes.
Yeah, scan them and print. And then it was the guys at Core who moulded them and poured them.
What did they turn out like?
Shockingly accurate, yeah.
Are they?
Yeah, it is crazy. It's hard to, you lose like a slight bit of detail, which like the shapes of the positions your fingers are in feel the same, but I mean, it is probably quite nice. They destroy your skin a lot less than the actual thing. I think basically the actual boulder, the rock is like really glassy, but the spikes are kind of spikier. So then you slide on the glassy bit and then like cut yourself on the spiky bits. But generally the holds are a bit less spiky, but have more texture. So generally you don't trash your skin as much, which is good, but getting the texture matched is really hard. Like, I think it's always going to be different. I don't really know how you'd replicate that. Yeah.
When were you? You probably talked about this, but when were you? When did you? When were you over there trying it? Was it?
So I did that in 2021. So yeah, just over 2 years ago, I went in autumn, and then I went back in October. And I'm not sure. Maybe I don't know if I'll find time in spring, but I'd like to hear. Well, I've gone in autumn both times, and it's been the first time I went, it was like probably less wet. I got the opportunity. It was quite wet, but like I could climb quite consistently. Whereas I had a harder time with conditions this time. It was like wet for a prolonged spell, and then got very, very cold. I wasn't very good in the cold, but from what I can tell and speaking to locals, apparently spring is generally a bit more reliable.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because I think when it's really cold and windy, well, I mean, for me anyway, I'm just sort of thinking like things like Voyager or, you know, the Ace and stuff, cold and windy is really good. But yeah, you can't stay out in those conditions very long, can you? And you can't really, you've got to be moving all the time and everything. So it's not really.
Yeah, I have quite bad circulation to my hands as well. And so I find if it gets too cold, it can be like such a fight to like actually get blood in my hands to be able to like feel the hold. Even if the friction is almost better, sometimes I think it's better for me to have like slightly worse friction, but like have sensitivity. But I think that's all, yeah, circulation related stuff. I definitely haven't figured out the nuances of gritstone conditions. I feel like that's quite a fine art.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, yeah, maybe everyone likes it, just really cold. Yeah.
And then it's a bit miserable to exist in.
Yeah. Right, a couple more questions. Are there people asking if there are any more moon board app updates coming? Because apparently at some point you might have said something about there being an ability to filter by least used holds or most used holds or things like that.
We're working on a load of stuff, actually. I'm not going to go into detail now, but yeah, no, there are a load of new features being added over the next 6 months.
No detail at all, Ben.
No.
Come on, mate, help me out. All right, that's exciting.
I'll give you one. 16 at 25 degrees. That's going to be released.
That would be good.
And we are considering making all of the setups available at different angles. A few people have been saying they think we should. It's a big decision, but.
Talk about that would be tricky for your app, boys.
That is going to be tricky for our boys. I think 2016 at 25 degrees, I think it'll. The other thing is basically showing there are loads of things. If a problem gets done at 40 degrees, it shows it at 25 degrees as a project. So people who've got adjustable boards and stuff, you can quickly see. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, that's nice. Mm. Yeah. You can see what the difference would be. Yeah. Okay, that's cool. And lots of people asking if you have any tips for how to make a good board.
Well, you just go to moonclimbing.com and
yeah.
Buy a moon board. We've done it for you.
And as you need some variation in your training, you can get all the sets. Four of them, why not?
But if you don't want to do that, just go to a skip and just find a load of old pieces of wood and then just chuck them on a board, blank board.
There you go.
Very good.
That's the budget version. I like it.
Did you enjoy traveling to other countries to try the other pre-existing hardest climbs in the world as much as you found just trying to new route your own hardest routes?
I mean, they're different. I mean, yeah, I did. No, I mean, it's traveling as well, isn't it? It's traveling with friends and climbing. So yeah, they're two different experiences, I feel. I enjoy both of them. I mean, if you're doing really hard stuff abroad, I think that comes as added pressure, doesn't it? because you've got those time constraints and everything. So that can be difficult to deal with, but yeah.
Because you did go try Action Direct once, didn't you?
Twice. I went in the year after Wolfgang did it, 92 in the spring, and then I went again in the autumn. I got injured in the spring. I had 5 days on it and got injured, and then went back in the autumn to try it again, but my fingers still didn't feel right, and then I've not been back since. Yeah, I mean, that's another one.
Another one you can go back for?
Well, I've got a few. There's a few, but yeah, that would be... I feel that might be more doable than Northern Lights, to be honest. When Buster did it 2 years ago, and he was messaging me, and he goes, "You can do this." He says, "It's not that hard. You can do it." You know,
that would be another great story. People were asking if you had any rock goals of any kind.
No, I don't. No, I've given up on goals. I'm too old now.
No more goals. Could you, and there are other people asking, going the other way with it, could you foresee a time when you think, that's enough climbing for me, I'm just going to go surfing all the time?
Yeah, it's a good question, that. I don't think so, no. I mean, I do a lot of indoor climbing these days. I mean, probably more indoor climbing than outdoor climbing, partly just because, again, it's very convenient and everything, but it's a great way of sort of staying in shape generally for life. So I just think, I would, even if I stopped climbing outdoors, which I don't think I will, I would still go to the local gym and climb indoors, you know, for the sort of health benefits and the social and that kind of thing.
Yeah, do you climb at other gyms other than the schoolroom?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Go to the Foundry, go to the Depot. Variety is key.
Variety is key. It's quite nice. It's like, I think that's what I've always hoped. I've definitely been pursuing kind of the performance side of climbing, but I've always really appreciated those other parts of climbing. I've like always hoped that I will keep climbing for as long as my body allows, because I feel like those other parts of climbing are so nice as well.
How long have you been climbing for now? Like, you know, sort of consistently?
Consistently, probably for 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years, yeah. I think your climbing, I mean, probably everyone's does kind of sort of evolves, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, what you do and stuff, and you know, because it's such a sort of diverse sport, isn't it? There's so many different aspects to it. And then as you age and your circumstances change and stuff, you have to sort of find your way a bit, don't you?
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely.
But I remember asking you a question not that long ago, actually. I asked you if you could be born into any era of climbing, which era would you choose? And I asked you that thinking of, you know, is he going to choose the era that you climbed in, or maybe Sharma or modern day? And you shocked me by going back in time to before you were born and talking about mountaineering and stuff. So I was wondering, do you think you might do some more alpine routes?
Possibly. I mean, I did a few. I had two trips to the Alps this year, and really enjoyed just doing sort of rock routes and stuff. And then, I mean, mainly, to be honest, over the last couple of years, I've mainly been doing trad climbing and bouldering indoors, really. So, but yeah, no, I could definitely see going back to the Alps or doing some long rock routes and stuff.
Sweet. All right, I think that's enough. There are loads more Patreon questions. We won't be able to cover them all. We can't take your time forever. We've already run over. So thanks so much for coming on, Ben, after all this time.
It's been really enjoyable. It's been great talking to you both. And
Ben, thanks so much for taking the time.
Questions for you.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll see you soon, no doubt, at the school.
Not that soon,
but hopefully, hopefully not 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, hopefully in a matter of weeks as opposed to months. Yeah. Yeah, that would be lovely. Oh, yeah. Well, thanks so much for taking the time.
Great. Enjoyable.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Okay, cheers.